Welcome to the Depollution Podcast from SalvageWire. It is a delight to welcome Mark Jones of ELV Training to this podcast, where we discuss leadership, we discuss training, and much, much more. You will find details of how to contact Mark in the show notes, but let's get on with the show. So welcome to Mark Jones, Director of ELV Training to the Depollution Podcast. Mark, it's great to have you on board and great to have you here. As a way of introduction, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your career, and your current role?
Yeah, well, first of all, Andy, thanks for inviting me. I do appreciate it. I know you're a busy man, but I'm hoping it's not because you're hard up for guests.
No, not at all.
My career has been really diverse. There was no big plan. I did go to college and got some O&A levels, but there was no real driver behind or passion to want to go to university. My passion was music and cars. And that's been my two loves, and they've followed me throughout life. So during college, I did have a part-time job, worked in a local garage, doing general repairs. And once I'd left college, I took a full-time job in the garage and did my apprenticeship there. Later progressed because I could earn more money, become a HGV driver. And then I went working for Pepsi, become a professional driver. And then they got, in 2009, they got the CPC, Certificate of Professional Competence, which every HGV driver has to do 35 hours of in-classroom training to keep their skills up to date. And because they formalised a qualification, because that became a European mandatory requirement, I ended up in a driver trainer's role. So there was no big plan to become a training manager or do anything like that. It's just these opportunities come up, don't they, during people's careers, and it's fair to say that I was just in the right place at the right time. Became a training manager very shortly after that, and you know, kind of put away my driving gloves, and then just had a keen interest in health and safety, which not a lot of people can say that they get very keen about health and safety. But I think having been a training manager, I was kind of looking and going, well, let's look at the fundamentals, what we're hanging all this training on here, which is kind of health and safety, NEBOSH. So I moved into health and safety roles and was a health and safety manager for Pepsi for 3 or 4 years. So it's, if you to summarize it, there was no great plan, and it's fair to say I've worn many hats, but collectively I've spent the last 15 years probably in learning development, specifically in environmental health and safety. So it's been a tough sell, because people don't necessarily look at health and safety as something of passion. They always look at it as it's a mandatory requirement, it's stuff that we need to do, not because we want to do it. And my passion for basically trying to creatively come up with ideas to turn people on about health and safety rather than it being something very prescriptive. And that's been a tough one. But engines has never left me. Anything with an engine, as we've had many conversations offline, haven't we? That's been an absolute constant in my life.
How difficult was that transition from, you know, driving and obviously your engineering background, but driving, but then into the training? How did you find that easy, or did you have to actually really work hard at that?
There's been aspects that I found that was quite difficult, but naturally moving, I mean, the opportunities just came my way. I didn't make the opportunities myself. I was in the right place at the right time, and I'm sure a lot of people have done that. They've had you know, career highlights where they've just made the most of an opportunity. I've been lucky in the fact that I've always been a good talker, I hope, you know. And I like kind of I've been a teacher for guitar, and it started with that kind of how to articulate to people in as few words as possible how to pick something up. So I've always thought that I had a little bit of talent for being able to take quite complicated tasks and breaking them down into smaller little bits. So I found that quite easy, and
Brilliant.
that's probably what opened doors in regards to how I would go about teaching people in future.
Excellent. Excellent. So now you're running ELV training. So can you tell us about ELV training and, how long has it been running? What was the inspiration behind that?
I've previously worked as a compliance training manager for European Metal Recyclers. You might have heard of them. I think that's how we met. And part and parcel of my job was looking after vehicle depollution dismantling for what was their 65 depots in the UK at that time. And what was quite clear to me there is that as an organisation, they ensured that all the plant operators could always adhere to an accredited standard, so that be MPOS, CPCS, Lantra, but we didn't have a formalised accreditation element to the depollution dismantling role. So I already knew there was a need there, and I had it in the back of my mind that I wanted to formalise what that training had looked like. And the reason behind that was where my office was, in EMR's head office, I was right next door to recruitment, human resources, and I experienced firsthand the attrition that they had in relation to trying to keep people in these vehicle dismantling and depollution roles. And I looked at that and I thought, yeah, training is the way to sort that problem out. It was certainly not about pay. And it certainly wasn't about being able to get people into those roles. It was about retaining those people, Andy. So that was going to be a big priority for me. Unfortunately, COVID came along and focuses had to shift elsewhere. There was a desire within EMR to rapidly accelerate employee training online, which meant traditional classroom-based training was just lifted and shifted into a virtual environment. And in fairness, that doesn't work. And it probably did e-learning a hell of a lot of damage. So I was wanting to right the wrongs. And that was the whole motive around ELV. First of all, sort out end of life vehicle depollution dismantling, formalize it, try and give it an accredited standard, and then also go about righting some of the wrongs that COVID's done over the last few years in regards to how we deliver effective workplace training. So that was the plan, really.
Brilliant. Brilliant. So explain what you do, explain what ELV training does. So if somebody comes on and registers, what do they get?
We have currently 29 e-learning courses. So what we realized early on around e-learning was that we needed to set it at an accessible level, so everything's at a level two qualification. And we wanted to catalogue all the different disciplines that the vehicle dismantling and recycling role would require. And what we've done is built on from that. So our syllabus now has become a spectrum of stuff there that can be accessible for foundation people who are looking to increase their skills, and those who have moved into leadership roles who want to gain a wider overview of this dismantling role. So we're the first training organisation in the UK to provide qualifications in relation to end of life depollution, and we adhere to that recognised competency standard that the sector introduced a couple of years back. I'm a big ambassador for organisations who best want to understand how they can leverage workplace training development, not just to improve compliance, but the kind of to maximise your operational efficiencies and motivate employees. And I'm hoping that using technology and e-learning, we can not only provide quality assured and consistent delivery models, but we can do it cost effectively and in a way that people don't feel intimidated. Not everybody works well in a classroom environment. So giving them the ability to take time to learn online at a pace that suits them, that works for a lot of people.
Yeah, brilliant. Now, I was at a conference a couple of days ago, and one of the seminars that I went into at that conference was about the skills shortage and staff turnover. And the couple of the people that were speaking there were talking about training apprentices, job changes, people coming into the industry from a different industry, you know, and how they, you know, and diversity as well. So getting more women into the industry and how they do that. But I actually raised the question at the time and I said, you know, great, it's all well and good. But actually, if the leadership of the company is not good enough, then this won't work. If the leadership in the industry, in the sector, isn't good enough, this won't work. So are you doing anything around good management, leadership and leadership development? Are you doing anything on that?
Well, as you know, with any business, good management and effective leadership are the key for a sustainable business. And, you know, our industry is no different. I think at the core of the ELVA training is we're sharing industry best practice. And that's important because that sets the whole framework for good management and leadership in our industry. Do we do any specific management and leadership courses? No, but what we do is understand the importance of sharing stuff. Business practices traditionally have always been very closed, closed shop. So it's been very much, I've got a good idea and I will keep my competitive edge by ensuring that I, you know, keep it within my organization. But now what I think we're realizing is we're in a period of transformation where good management and leadership and inspiration in this industry is about sharing best practice. And there's no finer example of showing the investment and transformation of businesses than the Charles Trent example that we've seen across social media in recent in the recent months. The way they're fostering their media coverage and publicity is they're literally opening the doors and inviting you in to see how they do it. There's no saying, oh, look what we produce. It's kind of come in and let's inspire the next generation of managers and leaders to decide, you know, whether or not you're going to go and duplicate what we're doing, our practice, or you're maybe going to go in a different direction. And that's what we try and condone here at the core of ELV training, is taking that good practice and sharing what the industry is doing. Yeah. And hopefully we've got to look at it is, you know, we're a community. That old business leader mentality where you never share a good idea and you because you're giving away your competitive advantage, yeah, that's things of the past. Yeah. So as a recycling community, you know, we're all working towards the same goal to decarbonize the planet, save the planet, to provide sustainable and viable and profitable vehicle recycling businesses for our customers' needs. There's room for everyone. So why wouldn't we share it? So, yeah. We're all about supporting that. Do we do any specific management and leadership roles? No. What we're about is culturally is making sure people have access to the best of what our recycling community can offer.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And obviously, you know, people listening to this podcast will come from all over the world. So ELV training is not just a UK product, is it?
No, not at all. That's one of the benefits of e-learning is that you can offer it in many different languages. Not that we offer it in any other language at the moment, but that is the vision. But I must admit, my initial strategy with ELV training was to devise something that would address the problems that we had in regards to the UK. I've spoke offline to you about this many times, Andy. What I did not anticipate was the amount of traction that we would get from the US and specifically India.
Yeah.
And what has been very surprising to me is that, and we've talked about this, they have a slightly different approach to how training looks. They go after training, they go after professional development. They put a lot of emphasis on finding your own way and building your progression routes. Whereas we are more prescriptive in the UK. I think it's fair to generalise that we like to be told what to do. We'll do it, but we like to be told what to do. And I think that's the most important thing to remember is that, yeah, e-learning is something that's accessible to everyone. So it's another great benefit.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Now, obviously, also listening to this podcast, but, you know, our younger people, people who are maybe, you know, a year or 2 years into their career, and maybe, you know, maybe aspiring to become leaders in the industry in the future. They're wanting to grow and develop and you know, work through the industry. What advice could you give those youngsters? Or let's put it another way. What advice would the current Mark give to 22-year-old Mark?
Well, that was a long time ago, Andy. Well, I think it's important to say, and I don't think you'll hear a lot of people saying this sort of thing, but nowadays we put a lot of emphasis on and value on fast-tracking careers and professional development and promotion. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying it comes with a word of caution. Because we run the risk of missing so much on the way up. Development, experience, learning from others, teamwork, understanding the value and contribution of others, building work friendships, learning about an organisation, learning about that art of decision making, getting along with your work colleagues, celebrating team successes. These are all things that potentially the leaders tomorrow may miss out on if they are uber focused on that scrambling up the ladder and increasing the salary and the rewards. Now, I know that's looking at it in a very negative aspect, but what I'm trying to do is emphasize that the best leaders and managers command respect because they have learnt the job. And those people run the risk of missing out on so much if they don't take the time to be exposed to everything an organization can teach you. It's not always just about college. It's not just about university. It's certainly not just about e-learning. It's just about saying for that journey, you know, aspiring to be a leader of tomorrow is about growing and developing your skills in the day job. Learn on the way up there. Not everybody wants to be a manager. We have to remember that. And not everyone else is cut out to be the next CEO. Mm-hmm. I mean, what would an organization structure look like if we all wanted to head to the top? It'd be top heavy. The business wouldn't survive.
Yeah.
But I don't believe HR departments and recruitment departments have worked that out yet. The further you move up the hierarchy, the less opportunities are available and the lonelier that journey becomes.
Very much so.
You know, lots of people on the shop floor, not so many in senior leadership. That's just the way it is. So realistically, some people are happy just knowing that they're valued and their contribution is making a difference. So that for me is a key leadership skill to take away from it. Learn on the way up there. Experience it, soak it up, because you'll learn so much more in doing that. About not just organizationally, but about working with other people. And that's what these jobs are about, yeah. Unless you're going to go and work for yourself, is building friendships and learning about you're so much more stronger as a team than you are as an individual.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Yeah, completely agree. And anybody listening to this podcast, hit pause right now and go back about 2 minutes and re-listen to what Mark has just said, because that is incredible advice for everybody who is coming up through the industry and aspiring to be a leader. So really, really good. Thank you, Mark. Changing tack slightly, we're heading towards a zero emission future. And how do you see that change impacting the industry? The increased levels of technology in the vehicles, the complexity of vehicle design and construction. And that will affect how they're sold, they're repaired, they're recycled. So do you see a future where technicians will need to be licensed because of the because of the complexity of the vehicles.
Absolutely, but you know, to be honest, we should already be there, Andy. You know, whether there's an argument for licensing technicians due to the fact that there's high voltages or the technological complexities, I think what's more important here is to look at other similar, other activities within our within our society. If I come to service your central heating system, I need to be qualified. If I come to rewire your household electrics, I need to be qualified. I need to be licensed to do so. Why should the automotive industry be any different? So again, I think, yes, we will, because of increased levels of technology and the complexity, we will be more, the argument will be more around making sure people are licensed. And yeah, there might be some future mandatory requirement behind it. But we should already be there. But maybe that's a lot to do. And I think that's a lot to do with the mindset. Again, UK mindset, we like to be told what we need to do, not how we need to go about doing it. So what I categorise as training because we have to do it, not because we want to do it. And I know it sounds quite negative. It's not meant to sound negative. It's just, it's where culturally, the UK, we are. And I think the right way to go about it is that vehicle technicians, you know, a lot can go wrong with a vehicle and I want to know I can stop it or it's not going to burst into flames. So I want to make sure that the people who are licensed and are working on that piece of equipment, you know, have reached the required standards. Yeah, we should already be there.
Brilliant. Now, you've worked in the vehicle recycling industry for a few years. You said earlier on for EMR, and you were heavily involved in the training side of that. Is there one thing the UK government could do that would have the biggest benefit to the recycling industry, and why?
Can we get political on this?
You can do, yeah, absolutely.
Is this where we lose sales, or is this is this where we make our enemies? Firstly, I mean, if you're talking from just from a from our business's point of view, and me personally, I was disappointed that the government chose to kick the can down the road and align the ban with the rest of Europe. But yeah, I'm not surprised. They set out a strategy 3 years ago, and in effect, since then, they've sat on their hands waiting for the private sector to lead the way, making the tough decisions, the huge financial and strategic investments, you know, moving technologies, supply chains, redesigning the product lines, building infrastructure, upskilling the workforce, and then guess what? They pull the plug. I think it's an opportunity miss for the UK to be world leaders. And admittedly, it was always going to be extremely ambitious.
Yeah.
So there's literally been no investment over the last 3 years from the UK government. So I think now we've aligned with Europe. The next government, whoever that may be, in 2024, will have to grab this opportunity with both hands.
Yeah.
Because there's still a time limit. You know, we've given ourselves 5 more years, but there's still a lot to do. So I think the UK government, the biggest benefit to the vehicle recycling industry is to support the industry in increasing depollution capacity for all types of vehicles. The current today's challenges is we've still got 96% of vehicles, cars, vans that are fossil fueled, and the priority needs to be focused on supporting that challenge, because that's the biggest one that treatment facilities face today. They need to process more vehicles.
Yeah.
We've got 1,951 ATFs in this in the UK, and we're processing 1.5–2 million vehicles a year. If you actually look at the DVLA facts, figures, they're telling us that there's over 17 million vehicles that will be off our roads in the next 5 years. So we're going to have to increase depollution and dismantling capability in this UK pretty rapidly. In fact, we're looking to, we're probably going to have to double our current output over the next 5 years.
Wow. That's a scary prediction.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. People are keeping cars longer. You know, there's more cars than ever on our roads. There's more cars that have gone round the clock. So, regardless of how these cars are coming in to treatment facilities, whether it because of insurance, or they're unroadworthy, it's not cost effective, repair it, dismantle it for repairs, they're still coming in through ATFs and they still need to be processed. So, the UK government needs to get behind us and support us, be it financially, be it by making strategic decisions, and helping us redesign what our treatment facilities represent and what we can do, what the throughput looks like. And the biggest part of that is looking at things like what Charles Trent are doing, which is looking is how can we eke every single bit of value out of a vehicle when it's reached the end of its life.
I mean, I've just done a very quick calculation, and if that prediction is correct, 17 million vehicles in 5 years,
And that's
with
just
one,
cars and vans, by the way.
with 1,951 processors. And if we just do a quick back of the fag packet calculation, that's 1,750 cars per year for every vehicle processor.
Yeah, regardless of size.
I mean, that is frightening.
And I think that the data's out there, so everyone can go out there. And if you go to my website, I've actually done a case study on this data, so it's there for everyone to download. But you can go and do your own due diligence on these facts. I'm not trying to scare people. I'm trying to present the facts in a way that potentially they haven't been presented before. And I look at this and I think, we've been doing the same thing now for 20 years or 23 years, and we need to do something different. If we're going to get to 2050 and be zero carbon, and it we're as an important factor of the whole circular evolution as those people that are manufacturing these vehicles. Yes, they're going to have to be more sensitive about using more recycled products, and it's going to be more traceability. But from a waste point of view, we're at the other end of the supply chain. We need to make sure that we are aligning with what the expectations are coming from, not just legislation, but from customer demands. And we're moving to electric. And for the time being, is going to be our single source for private transportation. So we need to embrace it, and we need to make sure that we're qualified to depollute these vehicles, but also qualified, more importantly, to depollute those 96% of fossil fuel vehicles that are still on our roads and are already, as I said, 17 million of them already heading towards a scrapyard in your area. So.
Well, I mean, it really does focus the mind when you put it into those sort of figures. It's amazing. That really is. Wow. Okay. Brilliant. I mean, that leaves us almost, on that cliffhanger, almost finished. And I'm going to leave, the listeners to go away and think about that and think about those figures, and actually what they're going to do. How are they going to work together as an industry? And that could be, the Vehicle Recyclers Association. It could be the British Vehicle Salvage Federation. And look at what they do, and look at the work that those two associations do. And join them and become part of the solution for this. I'll leave listeners to decide. But Mark, final question, and this is one we ask all our guests on the podcast. What was your first car, and do you have any special memories of that car? And please keep it clean.
Ouch. Yeah, I had a rather unreliable blue British Leyland Mini that provided the perfect platform to foster my curiosity in all things automotive, because it did nothing but break down. And do I have, yeah, I have many memories, and I will keep them clean. I turned it over. Oh, yeah, I used to live down in Maidstone and would go up onto the Downs, and I thought I was a bit of a rally driver. Fancied myself as a bit of a Colin McRae, and I found quickly the limits of my talent. Ended up in a ditch and turned it over. And do you know what? We managed to turn me and my friends, we managed to turn it back onto its head, and we popped the roof back up and off she went again. So not that unreliable after all.
I was about to say, not that unreliable. No. Brilliant,
Battered.
brilliant. Yeah, I think yeah, one of the most common responses that we've had when we've asked that question is pretty much, probably 70% of our guests have, their first car's been a Mini, and exactly the same. Brilliant cars, absolutely brilliant cars, fabulous.
I think it's a, yeah, it might be an age thing that, isn't it? You
Yeah,
know,
yeah,
what was
yeah.
affordable? But yeah, I think I only damaged a headlight and one of those, you know, the little indicators they've got at the bottom below the
Yeah,
headlight. And you
yeah.
know, the scrapyard.
Brilliant. Way to go. Way to go. Mark, it's been brilliant talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
No.
And it's an amazing story. So much in there that people can go back and listen to again and learn from. So thank you very much for taking the time.
No, thank you for inviting me.
Brilliant.
Thank you, Mark, for your time and your expertise and your knowledge. It was an absolute pleasure. As I said earlier, you'll find more details of how to contact Mark in the show notes. Please rate and like this podcast, and please pass it on to your friends and your colleagues as well. Get them to listen. And we'll see you on the next podcast.